Morning and welcome here this morning. I hope you've had a good week. It looks like a wonderful and a beautiful day outside as the sun is shining. It's not raining. It's not too cold. Wonderful fall day by the grace of our Lord. The last couple of days I had the pleasure, well, I'm not actually sure if it's the pleasure, of watching my daughter and her friends play volleyball. Because the stress of volleyball, I have learned volleyball has got to be one of the most stressful sports that exists. I mean, the score just constantly flips back and forth, and your heart wavers with the score. And I'm actually quite happy that all the schools now, it's mandatory for them to have a defibrillator in there, because the way my heart reacts to a volleyball game, and I don't even know if I like volleyball. But I like watching the kids play. They did well. I hope you enjoyed your week as well. I've been looking forward to continuing our study in Nehemiah here this morning. It is quite the book. The more I read it, the more I study it, the more I realize the godly practicality that is emphasized throughout the pages of Nehemiah as we see God highlighted in Nehemiah's life. I think often when we read some of these accounts, we can become enthralled with the individual that the account is writing about. So Nehemiah or Ezra, or maybe it's the story of Moses or David or some of these other individuals throughout the scriptures, and we think, wow, what a great person. And yes, God used them in magnificent ways, but rather than looking at them as an individual, I think our hearts and our eyes need to be turned to the God that is causing all things to take place for His glory and has called these individuals, has redeemed these individuals, has empowered these individuals, and by His sovereign hand has guided these individuals. And Nehemiah is no different. This morning we come to Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 9 to 20. We'll be looking at that, and the title of the message this morning is Galvanizing. Galvanizing. And you're probably thinking, that's a strange word. It's, you know, we think of galvanized steel. But galvanizing, when it's applied to us as individuals, means to stimulate or excite into action. It's that same principle of electrically charging metal, which produces galvanization, but electrically charging ourselves or one another to stimulate them or excite them into action or into a current course or direction. And that is an important aspect of leadership. It's an important aspect of humanity that we get engaged in things, we see the importance in things, we buy into them, and we become unified around them, and then we go towards this greater good for God's glory. Every leader needs to understand galvanizing. They need to take command in difficult situations, or be willing to take command in difficult situations, engaging people to believe what is presented and the purpose and the results that are sought, and then to follow after that direction, that they may conclude and bring into realization that which has been presented. And in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 9 to 20, we come face to face with galvanizing. As God has answered Nehemiah's prayer, God has moved the heart of the king to lead Nehemiah and to allow Nehemiah to be able to leave and to go to Jerusalem to complete this task, or to enter into this task of building the walls. And yet Nehemiah cannot do that by himself. In fact, we'll find out he needs an army of individuals. They say it takes a village to raise a child. It must take a city to resurrect the walls. Turn to Nehemiah chapter 2 and let us read together verse 9 to 20, to the end of the chapter. Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the Dragon's Well, and on to the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. Then I said to them, "You see the bad situation which we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire? Come, let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach." I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, "Let us arise and build." So they put their hands to the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, "What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" So I answered them and said to them, "The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem." Let us bow our heads for a word of prayer. Dear Lord, I thank you for this wonderful, beautiful day that you have given us. Lord, I thank you for the breath of life that you have breathed into each and every one of us. And Lord, I pray that we would use the days that you have ordained for us for your glory, that we would engage in your creation, and that we would participate rightly in the things that you have provided for us for your glory, that we would share the gospel, that we would seek to lead well for the sake of the gospel, for your mission, that your name would be heralded on every street corner. Lord, I pray that you would teach us, that you would direct us, that you would guide us. Lord, I pray that you would soften our hearts, that you would open our minds to the truth, that your Spirit would work in our lives, bringing the knowledge of the truth, making us wise, though we be but simple. Be with us here this morning. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Verse 9 to 10 of our passage here this morning sets the stage once again. As you go through Nehemiah, like many of the narrative books of the Bible, each scene seems to have this introduction and this setting for us to understand what is taking place and where this is taking place, and some of the thoughts even behind what is taking place. And verse 9 to 10 definitely sets the stage for this next scene. We're introduced to Sanballat, Tobiah. Later on, we're introduced also to Geshem, which I'm certain would have been part of this displeased group about the knowledge of the welfare of the sons of Israel being sought. But what we're introduced to in these two verses is the opposition that is going to be before Nehemiah as we progress through this book. Now, Sanballat was the governor or in charge of the region of Samaria. Sanballat is a Babylonian name. Sanballat finds his history in the Moabite people. And if you read through the Old Testament, you can learn about Israel's difficulties with the Moabite people. In fact, even their sin that they entered into through the persuading of the Moabite people. Tobiah is a Hebrew name that's given to him. Probably he would have been a servant to Sanballat. It tells us here that Tobiah is an Ammonite official, but most likely underneath Sanballat. To get further insight into who Tobiah is, we could look at Ezra chapter 2, verse 59 to 60, as those who had been taken away into exile are now returning to Jerusalem. They are looking at the Levites and they're looking at the families and they're trying to find out the descendancy and the lineage of each of them. And Tobiah is mentioned here, and it's probably the family of Tobiah that is mentioned at this part or at this point in Ezra. But Tobiah could not prove his lineage. He could not prove his descendancy, and so a portion would not have been given to him. And this is important because Israel is trying to reestablish the covenant people, the people that God has promised to, and to set themselves off on a way of right-footedness and sure-footedness, a way of reform, not to enter into the sins of the past. Geshem is an Arab and is representative of the Eastern Arab nations. We read about that in verse 19. And it is these developing nations around Jerusalem that are growing and have been gaining in prominence since the exile. First, the Assyrian captivity of the northern tribes, and then the exile of the two southern tribes when the southern kingdom went into Babylon. These nations, and Samaria particularly, have been growing and seeking to leverage their newfound power within the area. And this is the history a little bit of the surrounding nations of the desolate Jerusalem that we're introduced to in verse 9 and 10. And we come to verse 10 here, and it says that these individuals were very displeased about the news that they had heard, that someone would dare come to seek the restoration, the welfare, the good being of the Jewish people. In fact, there is a word that is repeated in the Hebrew there, ra-ra-ha-ha, which means to be greatly disappointed. In fact, in direct translation, it is evil, evil. It's not just evil, but the evil that is all around us is even more evil, is what Nehemiah records their response to be. It says it's very displeasing to them, that they felt that this was a punishment towards them, that this was bringing great harm or adversity towards them, that this was an evil act of wickedness, that someone would dare be concerned about Jerusalem, about the Jewish people. And, you know, when we turn on our TVs today or read our newspapers, we see that this attitude toward the sons of Israel is still very, very present. How could anybody be concerned about the well-being of Israel? In fact, the ESV records it as a great evil that Nehemiah would come and would entertain these thoughts and these ideas of restoration. This is far more, and we need to understand this, is far more than just a quiet concern or even a discomfort or even, well, this is a disagreeable situation. We're going to have to change our plans for our own Samaritan Empire or our own Arab dreams. No. No, the issue here is a deep heart of hatred that someone would dare seek the good of Israel. And I think right out of the gate here, we're confronted with a reality that often we don't like to observe or recognize, and that is that blessing and direction and opportunity generally do not come difficulty-free. God had already blessed Nehemiah. He says in the end of our section of last week in verse 8 that the king had granted these things to me because the good hand of my God was on me. That he's going out to do the good work of God, and God had blessed him. And yet here, right away, there is difficulty. There is difficulty. I think we need to consider that in our own lives when we endeavor. And if we want to lead anything worthwhile leading, we are most likely going to run into difficulty. And it's been said, if all you want is friends, then go sell ice cream. We see here already in these verses the battle of good and evil being presented. Verse 9, then, is better understood when we look at verse 10, why the necessity for Nehemiah to have these letters of access to move through these different nations for safe passage, and why also in verse 9 we read that Nehemiah was sent with officers of the army and horsemen, that Artaxerxes had sent Nehemiah on this journey, But he didn't send him by himself. He knew there would be opposition. And he sent with him part of the king's army to protect Nehemiah and to guard Nehemiah as he moved from the Persian Empire back into the region of Jerusalem. In verse 19 to 20, Nehemiah is taking command. He's empowering the people. We find a wise confidence and an unwavering faith in Nehemiah as we read from verse 11 down to the end of the chapter. But this wise confidence and this unwavering faith that we find of at the end of this chapter is presented because Nehemiah knows his God. And Nehemiah has not willy-nilly entered into this expedition, this endeavoring. And Nehemiah has, by God's great hand, galvanized the people around him to enter into this work wholeheartedly. And in these verses, verse 11 to 20, there are three keys that we want to look at here this morning to galvanizing a group successfully. Not manipulating a group successfully, but galvanizing a group successfully, being a good leader. And the aspects of good leadership that are necessary in order to gain the buy-in that is necessary from a group, that belief that is necessary from a group, that the task be successfully done. And so the first point we want to look at here this morning is found in verse 11 to 16, and it is called strategic silence. Strategic silence. I think often we think silence is just passivity. But we need to learn to be silent in big situations. We need to know when to talk and when not to talk. And in verse 11 to 16, it says, "So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days." That Nehemiah didn't just right away throw this big party. But he went to Jerusalem and he waited there 3 days. He didn't talk to anybody. We see that later in verse 16. He didn't go out and express his plans right off the hop. He wasn't overly ambitious or overly excited, but rather he quietly and patiently and wisely waited. He wasn't quick to presume that there would be a positive response to all these desolate people that now Nehemiah had rode in on his horse, was about to save. But rather he sat silently. Nehemiah's first engagement is not political, and it's not promotional. There's no public event. There's no news flash in the local paper. There's no campaign promises. This is what I'll do for you if you just vote for me. There's no who's who dinner. Rather, there's just this strategic silence and this strategy that develops in a very unusual or unseen way in our world today. Verse 12, Nehemiah arose in the night, not during the day, not wanting to be noticed by all those around him. And he went out and he inspected the city. He inspected the city. And there's two observations here that I want us to hold fast to in regards to strategic silence. The first is this, the wisdom of contemplation. The wisdom of contemplation, of processing, of taking in what's about to happen, considering what's about to happen, thinking upon what must be done, not just jumping into the deep end of the pool. I remember the years that we were at Rosa River Bible Camp serving there, and our kids were quite young at that time, and Kira in particular. Little Kira, she is so brave, no fear, which is a good thing in some ways, and it's a bad thing when you're a parent. But Colleen was with her at the swimming pool one day, and Kira loved the water. And she walked over to the deep end of the pool, little Kira, not knowing how to swim yet, and just dove right in. And Colleen followed. And up she comes with Kira, and Kira isn't that worried about it. Mom is worried about it, but just jumping right into the deep end of the pool. And as adults, we see the foolishness of that. As kids, we don't see the risk. But hopefully also here this morning, we can see the importance The importance of not just jumping into any situation. And often when we just jump in when we're unready or unprepared, we start flailing around in the water, and quite possibly we may suffer the consequence of drowning. There is great wisdom in contemplation. And the wisdom of contemplation is the time that is taken during contemplation. And there's two areas of this wisdom of contemplation. The first is careful prudence. Careful prudence. And I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. And verse 16, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. I didn't tell anybody anything yet. I was prudent about this. I guarded myself. I guarded the plan. And I guarded the plan of that it wouldn't go out prematurely and people not understand it. I guarded the plan so that the enemies around me who were seeking to derail this wouldn't have time to come up with a plan or an idea to derail the whole thing and throw the whole thing off before it ever gets started. Careful prudence, waiting and thinking. And Nehemiah is a wonderful example of this. Another illustration for you, holding patterns. There's pilots in our congregation that worship with us, and they know very much the importance of holding patterns. And for those of us sitting on a plane, we maybe just think, come on, land already. I'm tired of being in this tin can as the plane circles the airport one more time. But the plane is circling the airport one more time, not just wasting time, but waiting for the appropriate time, the right time, the safe time to understand all that's going on, that they may land on the proper runway. And every plane must come down. We all know this. But hopefully when they come down, they hit that right runway and they take us to that right gate. That's what we all want at the end of our trip. I think times in our life, we need to have careful prudence. We need to take the time. We need to enter into those holding patterns. We need to not just jump right in and suffer the consequences of being abrupt. But not only that, the wisdom of contemplation isn't just careful prudence, but it's careful evaluation. And in verse 13 to 15, we get this very clear historic description of the state of Jerusalem. In fact, these verses have been spoken of much as they portray very clearly and vividly the city of the past and the destruction of this city. And Nehemiah sees the necessity of rightly evaluating and observing for himself. He's heard the stories. They came to him in the palace. He heard the stories, but he has not seen. He has not seen. He didn't live in Jerusalem. He's just heard it's desolate. There's a need. It's like the missionary who knows in some other country there are people that need the gospel. And they think, well, then I'll go. And they get there and they realize, what am I doing here? I don't even know where to go. I didn't know they had so much forest. I didn't know I'd have to eat these things. I didn't know it would be like this. The idea is great, but there needs to be an evaluation, a right evaluation. There needs to be a gathering of the right perspective. And in verse 13 to 15, we see that this is exactly what Nehemiah does. He gains a visual perspective. He gains a perspective on the weight of what is actually going on. He gains a perspective of the societal impact that he can truly be empathetic to the people, understanding what they have gone through, what they have lived through. He's taking note of the tasks that need to be accomplished and the extent of the tasks that need to be accomplished in the rebuilding of this wall. And yes, the societal impact. He's taking note as he's understanding the state of the people, what they have lived through, what they have gone through, the fears that they have. As he carefully evaluates, he's seeking to understand the scope of the destruction and the discouragement. And it's estimated that the wall, in a very modest estimation, that needed to be rebuilt around Jerusalem was anywhere between 1.5 to 2.5 miles. And they don't have an excavator or a bulldozer or dump trucks. 1.5 to 2.5 miles of this boulder-filled wall. And Jerusalem is an elevated city. And so as the wall has been pushed over and destroyed, these massive rocks and boulders would have rolled down the hill and away from the city. And they need to somehow gather these up and rebuild this wall. What an impossible, what an overwhelming task. And so Nehemiah, in great wisdom, in strategic silence, shows the wisdom of contemplation, the wisdom of prudency, the wisdom of evaluation. And every good leader needs to take the time to develop a course of action that's achievable and to really understand the heart of the problem that they are dealing with. But as we think about strategic silence, there's a second aspect to that. Not just the wisdom of contemplation, but look once again at verse 12, the second part. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. I didn't tell anyone what God was doing. The inner working of God is evident, or needs to be evident, during a period of silence. We may not be moving as fast as others would like us to move. We may not be saying everything that others might want us to say, or what even we want to say. But it doesn't mean by any stretch that God is silent. For God is not. Psalm 143. David writes in verse 8, "Let me hear your loving kindness in the morning, for I trust in you. Teach me the way in which I should walk, for to you I lift up my soul. Deliver me, O Lord, from my enemies. I take refuge in you. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. Let your good spirit lead me on level ground for the sake of your name, O Lord. Revive me. In your righteousness, bring my soul out of trouble." And Romans chapter 8, verse 14 tells us that those who have a relationship with God are being led by the Spirit of God. And often in our lives, I think we feel like Spirit catch up to us. This is where we need to be going. But strategic silence doesn't mean God is silent. It is a period of time that we are meditating, that we are waiting intentionally on the Lord, realizing that we cannot. And I think as Nehemiah walked around the city and looked, it was reiterated probably again and again and again into his own mind that this task is too big. I've had this great burden in my life and upon my heart to help my people, to love my people. And God has made a way for me to get here. But God, how can I? This problem is huge. This problem is huge. Waiting on the Lord, I can't, but He can. And we often miss this. And yet we need desperately, if we expect to be successful in leadership, if we expect to be successful in life, we need to take deliberate holy pauses in our lives where we allow the Lord to minister to us, where we meditate upon His Word, where we submit ourselves to the guidance and direction of the Spirit of God to bring us to the place that we should be. Not necessarily the place that we are, but the place that we should be. And Nehemiah says, "I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do." Sanctification is the internal work of God to change us, to direct and influence our thoughts and our lives for His name's sake. Consider the importance of God leading and guiding our minds and our hearts to His will. And when it comes to strategic silence, certainly God was directing, and certainly it was God who had lit the fire in Nehemiah's heart. What about us? What about the things we are doing? Do we take the time to be strategically silent, to quiet ourselves before God, seeking His direction and making sure it's His direction and not our own? I believe it's also during this time that God gave Nehemiah the plan for how to go about rebuilding this wall. As Nehemiah looked and saw and listened, God was working mightily and marvelously in Nehemiah's life. But not just strategic silence. We can't just sit there quietly forever. The second point, the second key in this passage is in verse 17 to 18, and it's propagating passion. Propagating passion. How do we create or allow passion to rightly develop in others? Verse 17 to 18, then I said to them, "You see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach." I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, "Let us arise and build." So they put their hands to the good work. We need to propagate passion. Our church needs to propagate passion. We need to be a passion-filled people, because common ground is movable ground. When we try to move it ourselves, it's impossible. When we come together united under the hand of God, common ground is movable ground. And vision, church, vision needs to be contagious. It must be contagious. It can't be driven by one or two or three people. We need to all get on board with the vision that God has given us and is directing us. Vision, our ideologies, our ideas, our passions, where we feel we're being led, they need to be relatable. They can't be and remain unrelatable. It can't be an us as that elite or inner group, and a them, those who just don't get it or don't understand, and we'll just somehow try to employ them into the work or the vision that we want to do. That kind of thinking doesn't work. It doesn't work, and it doesn't work for long, if it seems to for a bit. Rather, the church is called to be unified. And Nehemiah, as he leads the Jewish people, as he draws them into what has to be done, what needs to be done, it isn't an us versus them mentality. It isn't, "I'm the guy that knows everything and you're the rest." But rather, he presents the task as being a joint effort. It is we, he says throughout verses 17 and 18. Take note of it. It says, we are in this situation, Nehemiah included. He says, "Let us, all of us together, so that we," he says. He doesn't say, "Have you looked at your lives, people? It's disgusting. I left the great palace halls to come down here to fix your problems. And if only you would listen to me, your problems would be solved." No. This is the situation we are in. And it's going to take all of us. It's going to take all of us coming together so that we can rectify, that we can rehabilitate the situation that we're in. Propagating passion means that we're building a common purpose. And building a common purpose is a powerful tool. Solomon, wise Solomon, writes in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9, "Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor." He's speaking just even worldly and fleshly at the start here. Hey, if one can make this much, guess how much two can make? But then it gets more than that. "For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. If reproach comes upon one, Solomon saying, is the other one is there to help him. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. That when we bind together, when we work together, much can be accomplished. Much can be accomplished is what Solomon is saying. And the approach that Nehemiah takes here in these verses to infuse passion and a can-do attitude, a realization of God who is at work, he takes a twofold approach. Verse 17, first he says, so we will not be a reproach anymore. You've seen the state. In fact, he says in verse 17, basically, we all are aware of the situation. He's not drawing their attention to it in verse 17, saying, hey guys, have you seen the wall? No, it's a reflective statement in verse 17. He's calling them to reflect and to review their history, the position that they're in, that this is Jerusalem, the city of David, the people of God, established not by your own hand, but by God's hand, a nation of promise that lies in ruin because of our disobedience. And we no longer can remain a reproach. We no longer can remain an approach. And so he says in verse 17, come. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. And it's a motivational come. It's not like we've seen everything and it's just the way it is. I know it's overwhelming, so whatever. Do your best. But no, he says, come. An invitation to get up, to wipe the dust away. And remember, he's seen the city. He's seen the state of the city. He understands the people. And he's entered into their own grief. He's entered into their own situation. He's reminded them that we're all part of this problem. But let us come together. Let us be the people, the nation of God that we are called to be. That we are called to be. And in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 6, as Moses writes to this young nation, he says, for you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord God has chosen you to be a people for his possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you nor choose you because you were more in number than any of the people. For you were the fewest of all the peoples. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, the Lord brought you out by mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God, who keeps his covenant and his loving kindness to 1,000 generations with those who love him and those who keep his commandments. And Nehemiah is employing them and reminding them of this. Let us no longer be a reproach, but let us come together and rebuild that which is ruined. He's calling them to be a reformed nation, a reformation. We always celebrate Luther's reformation, but this is the early reformation of Israel. Ezra was already bringing this reform in Ezra 6:19 and in Ezra 10:1. He's calling them back to be the people of God. And now Nehemiah comes on the scene and he says, hey, let us rebuild the city. That God be glorified. That we would no longer be a reproach. That we would no longer be disgraceful or shameful. Nehemiah is calling the people to a cleansing. God's judgment through their exile. And yet now they have returned and their sin is still ever before their eyes as the city lays in destruction. He's calling them to recognize the nations that are around them, that see them as weak, as desolate, as vulnerable. This is not who the people of God are to be. And he's calling them to remember the name of God, that they wouldn't be mocked, that God's name wouldn't be mocked, that God wouldn't be defamed. That the nations around would be reminded that the covenant of God will stand and the people of God will prevail. Let us no longer be a reproach. Let us rebuild. And secondly, as he propagates this passion, verse 18, he speaks of the grace and the mercy he has received, that he has indeed found favor. And Nehemiah, unlike some of us, does not bury the lead. He starts off first, it's God. I know it's overwhelming, but God is on our side. He says, I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me. That God is being merciful and gracious, and God has turned his eyes back towards us, and God will help us complete this task. God will see it through. God will carry us through. Put your hope and your faith in God. And then secondly, he says, and the king, Artaxerxes, the one who lords over us. The king is for us. The king's words, which he had spoken to me, he says. Nehemiah's testimony is a call to remember the greatness of God, and specifically his sovereignty, as he says, the hand of my God, and the compassion of God, as he says, how this hand of God has been extended to me, and the turning of the king's heart, his support and stamp of approval, the letters that Nehemiah would have received, which all of this would have been an important fact after their previous difficulties, as well as the king's provision to the lumber that would be needed. Nehemiah's call is to God's provision in hand. He's telling the people, we're not alone. We can do it. And Nehemiah, like good leaders, brings to life obligation, a sense of purpose and need, as well as possibility, belief that it can be done. And these are two key elements in galvanizing. Obligation. We need to do this. We have a duty, a responsibility, and then the possibility. We can do this. Our God is great. Our God is great. Church, do we cultivate passion in others? Do we rightly remind them? Do we rightly call them to turn their eyes towards God for his glory? That this church is more than just this building. It's more than just Sunday morning. But we have a duty and a call as this body, as this family, for the glory of God. Note the response after properly appealing and motivating to the people. Verse 18, the people say, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. It's interesting that when you go about spreading vision properly and cultivating unity and passion, that you don't have to tell people what to do so much as people are willing to do what needs to be done. The press to proceed at this point in this chapter is from the people. Nehemiah is no longer begging with them. They say, let us rebuild. And then it says, and then they did. And then they did. Vision needs to be contagious, and common ground is movable. Dragging people along just will wear out your tires. This brings us to the last point here this morning. Strategic silence and propagating passion, and then confident conviction. Confident conviction, verse 19 and 20. And verse 19 and 20, just like verse 10, remind us to be alert, to be on guard, that the devil prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking to devour, seeking to dissuade. Our eyes need to be open. We need to be alert and ready. The devil, the flesh, and the world are not our friends. They don't want to see the things of God proceed. They don't want to see God's plan accomplished and fulfilled. Adversity is to be counted on. And in verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us. And they despised us, and they said, they threatened them, what is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Man, you know, I remember when I was in public school, just a young guy, and my dad being a pastor, I was terrified about anything wrong or bad getting back to him. And I remember some of the kids on the playground, when they didn't like what I was doing or they wanted something for me that I wouldn't give them, they would say this: "Well, we're going to tell the teachers that you were swearing." I hadn't sworn. But all of a sudden, I was overcome by fear and anxiety, like, oh, I'm going to get in trouble for swearing. Oh, they're going to come down on me, and then they're going to tell my parents, and I'm going to be in big trouble. And sometimes I would give in to that. That's the tactic that's happening here. That's the tactic here. They mocked them and despised them, and they said, "What are you doing? You're rebelling against the king." With the implication, we're going to tell Artaxerxes that you're just trying to rise up against him. Adversity is to be counted on. The world, and in this case the world is Samaria, Ammon, and the Arab nations that are rising up against Israel. The flesh, fear of consequence, harm. Truth has no burden here in these statements, and we need to realize that when it is the case. It is about creating anxiety to cool the flames of progress and confidence. That they would become fearful, that they would look at the consequences, and the consequences would outweigh that which is called of them in obedience. Ephesians chapter 6. "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day, and having done everything, to stand firm." The world, the flesh, and the devil are against us. The devil, unmentioned in here, but most definitely the orchestrator of adversity. Accusations are always the weapon of the enemy. For in Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, Satan is called the accuser of the brethren. And Satan, the word itself, means adversary. He is your adversary. He is against you. Which brings us to the great importance, even against fear, and even against real fear, to be filled with the Spirit, to keep our eyes on Christ and his word. And you know, you can be doing a lot of good things in this world. You can even be doing a lot of good things in this church. But who are you leaning on? Who are you leaning on? Are you ready for difficult times? Are you ready for the attacks of the enemy? Because they're going to come. Confident conviction does not originate in man, but rather in the God who gives and is ever faithful. Verse 8, Nehemiah must at this point have been reminded that the good hand of my God was on me, was with me. In verse 12, that quiet time with God, as God was placing things in his mind, assuring him, giving him confidence. Reminds me of Matthew 14, verse 28 to 31. When the sea is raging, the disciples are in the boat, terrified. And Jesus comes on the water. And Peter gets up. And he sees Jesus. At first they're afraid. It's a ghost. They see Jesus. And Peter first shows boldness. "There's my Lord." And he says, "Lord, if it's really you, then tell me to come out of the boat. I'll come out of the boat." And he gets out of the boat. He's obedient. He gets out of the boat. And he walks on water. The good hand of God upon him. But then we care about Peter's eyes, don't we? Because the next part says Peter noticed the waves and the wind and the storm and the adversity. We'll tell the king. You'll never do it. And Peter sank. But then, Peter looks back to his Lord. Help! And reaching up is brought back up out of that water. Verse 20 gives us God-given bold assurance. Nehemiah's response. Look at Nehemiah's response. And pay attention to the order of Nehemiah's response, by the way. So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven will give us success. That's his first statement. This is the best response ever, by the way. This is confident conviction at work. Nehemiah says, it's God who's in charge here. God is the utmost. God is our boss. It's almost like Nehemiah turns to them and says, hey, you got a problem with me? Go talk to my boss. God's in charge. Nehemiah says, the God of heaven will give us success. He turns to God first. He brings God into the situation. And then look what he says, secondly. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. First, God is the utmost. He's the boss. He's in charge. Secondly, we, positionally, us, we're his slaves. We're his servants. We have no choice here but to be obedient. Therefore, we will persist. We will persist. And we will build these walls. We'll build these walls. And then look what he says. But you have no portion here, no right, no memorial in Jerusalem. You see, Nehemiah has a clear understanding that God is in control, not these fellas. That God has called him to this task. He has spent the time seeking the Lord. That the Lord would lead him rightly. He has quietly waited upon the Lord. He has taken that and he has rightly empowered the people of God. That they would be infused with passion for the work of God, not the work of Nehemiah. And then he turns to the enemies of God with a clear understanding that you are not us. You are outside. You have no portion here. You have no right. The bold assurance of Nehemiah. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 3, it says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. And we are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete. Nehemiah understood this. And Nehemiah presents to us a good formula to consider as we encounter difficulties and as we endeavor to be pleasing to God. Strategic silence, propagating passion, confident conviction. May God be glorified as we walk wisely. Nehemiah can teach us a lot, but like I said at the beginning, he is not the star. He is not the star of this chapter, of this account. God is. By God's redemptive grace, Nehemiah is who he is. After all, it was as verse 12 says, what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. God is the initiator. God is the equipper. God is the sustainer. And we would be wise as we lead to follow him. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I just thank you for this morning that you've given us. I thank you for your word. I thank you for the very practical lessons we can learn as we go through Nehemiah. But Lord, let us not apply these things to our lives in the flesh, but may we seek the Spirit of God who empowers, who transforms, who sanctifies. May we follow where you lead. May we be strengthened by your mighty hand. May we recognize our own weakness. And Lord, may we walk humbly before our God. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.